love this podcast? Support us by leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Hit the link in the episode description to support us now. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
Hello, Rolando. I must not fear. Fear itself is compromising and it will not own me.
Hello, Nicole.
I hope she doesn't know that I try to make plans without her for this weekend.
How are you doing, Nicole? Are you going to do anything this weekend?
Oh, yeah, we have plans this weekend, right? I must not fear, for fear is the enemy. I should just tell them how I really feel.
Shit. She's bringing up the weekend. I didn't want to talk about the weekend. What? Why did I do this?
Yeah, no, this weekend is going to be quite busy for me.
Wow, I thought it was going to be more of like Dune references, but it just went into us shading each other.
I guess. Well, I mean, let's be real. Most inner monologue is shading. I feel like even Dune, they were just shading each other when they were doing their inner monologues.
This is true. Well, yeah. But other times they were like giving themselves prep talks.
Yeah, backstory, I suppose.
Like, backstory, you know, pep talks. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Which we kind of did. It's just like, oh no, I don't want to hang out. So anyway, that was the cold open, guys, because what are we covering this week? We already talked about it. We just said it.
It's Dune. We're talking about Dune. We're doing it. We're Dune it. We're Dune-ing it.
Are you kidding me? You just took my joke? I'm so mad right now.
The opportunity presented itself. I'm sorry, you know?
I even stopped myself when the opportunity presented itself earlier. And you know what? Let's just get right into it. I'm Rolando.
And I'm Nicole.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast about unoriginality. I am House Pimenti. House Pimenti has honor and does not back down when an opportunity presents itself.
You know, I just want to let everyone know that I had this funny thing I was going to say, like, hey, Nicole, how you doing? And she ripped me off, so whatever. I'm House Nieves, and we're just bitter people. We're very much like the Baron.
The Harkonnens?
The Harkonnens, thank you. Yes, that's basically my house.
I don't know. I don't know if you're going to want to make comparisons of yourself to that guy.
I will, please. Living gluttony, float around, sounds like a dream to me.
Yeah, okay. Well, before we get into that. So, Dune is a book from 1965 by Frank Herbert. I have not read this book. Eddie Rolando, have you read this book?
I definitely have not read this book.
It's on the list. Maybe a book club read.
So, preface, for anyone who's a diehard book fan, you will be vastly disappointed by this episode because we are going to focus on the media properties. And we're going to speak to as much as we can about what Dune offers us in terms of the story that we get from the movies and a little bit of the miniseries, but we will not be talking about the book. I'll talk a little bit about the history of the book, but I just want to throw that out there right now. This is not about the book. It's about
no,
the movies.
We're not, you know, literati. So,
yeah.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah, Remakes, Reboots, Revivals, we should say, for movies and TVs and stuff. So
it's very rare when I have read the book.
It's very rare when you read a book.
Shush.
Ooh.
No. So I've been burned when I try to read a book that's going to be adapted into a movie because then the movie doesn't get made. And I just like, oh, I read that book for nothing then.
Oh,
I want to be one of those people who one day can be like, it's like, oh, I read the book before the movie came out or the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
The Rook, I guess, was on run, but I hated the TV show, so I didn't watch it.
Dune is a science fiction novel that came out in 1965, like I said, by Frank Herbert. It was originally published as two separate serials. An analog magazine, and then it was released as one full book. You know, according to Wikipedia, it was 412 pages, but according to Goodreads, it's like 670. I mean, according to you, it's 1,000 pages. Who knows? But this is
it's a mystery.
But this is a really, really detailed, character-driven, just dived into this complete world kind of a book, right? That's evident from these films.
It just feeds into my conspiracy theory that no one knows how long this book is because no one has read this book. They just say they have.
Maybe. I don't think so. This book was actually the first book to win the Nebula Award for best novel, which is the annual award that gives out to science fiction and fantasy works of writing, whether it's a movie or a book or a poem or a graphic novel, etc.
Really? I didn't know it could go for movies.
Yeah, for script, for TV or movie writing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Yeah, I'm familiar with Nebula because of this TV show I watched called Mystic Quest.
Oh, okay. Let's just, before we talk about these movies, Dune is such a complicated plot that we kind of just have to get it all out of the way. And
That's so interesting. So you think the plot is complicated? Because I feel like both movies did a good job of dumbing it down then.
Well, there's just so much to it, and there's so much world building, and the movies really had this task of, how do we get all this information dump done? Mm-hmm. And they did it in very different ways.
Correct.
But, you know, the information is important for the listener, just so they can be on the same page for us, you know, before we actually talk about the movies and how they handled that information dump. Do you want to, I mean, since you said they did a really good job and it doesn't sound that complicated, why don't you summarize Dune?
Right, sure. So the emperor, he's a weak emperor, and part of his weakness is that he is losing the faith in the empire, which is, he's the emperor of the known universe, and I think that consists of like at least 4 planets that we know of. Sorry guys, I'm running off of the movies that I know. So not the books. I don't know if there's more planets out there. The way the empire works is that we need spice from this planet, Arrakis?
Arrakis, right? Yes.
Thank you. Arrakis is spice. That is, the production of spice is overseen by House Harkonnen, and they are in charge of the spice manufacturing, but the emperor and the baron, who is the leader of House Harkonnen, they devise a plan to get rid of this duke of House Atreides, Leto, who is his beloved duke, right? He's like a fair guy. He's like, you know, beloved by like the empire because they hear he's just a wonderful guy, probably hot. And, you know, everyone's just on his jock. So the baron and the emperor devise a plan to, you know, have him executed. And bada bing, bada boom, they think everything is cool and done until, oh my God, the son of the duke is coming back with a vengeance. And that's going to kick off to the second half of the book. If you only watched like the Denis Villeneuve movie, I don't want to go into that.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
it's like interesting, right? Because like the Denis Villeneuve movie only covers half of the book,
mm-hmm. whereas right? the David Lynch film covers the entire book. Yeah,
in about the same runtime. So
you know. Actually, shorter.
Oh no way! The David Lynch movie is shorter.
Mm-hmm. By like 15 minutes.
It feels longer.
It does feel longer, which is actually amazing. You see, pacing, it's a thing. So that's a lot. And you only just covered kind of like the basic mechanics of it.
And yeah, those are like your main plot points.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's a lot.
That was rough. That was a rough summary.
Was that a rough summary?
Yeah, I don't know why I pass it over to you. Sometimes I wonder why I do things.
How dare you guys? I thought that was a great house summary.
It was kind of all over the place, much like the 1984 movie. So
yeah, that was a David Lynch summary.
So it's 1984, right? David Lynch made Eraserhead in 1977, his AFI thesis film that everybody kind of looked at and said, you know, what the fuck is this? This is really interesting. Then he got a position in Hollywood and they gave him The Elephant Man. Right, a really great mm-hmm. film, but a studio film nonetheless. So he kept getting studio films, and long before David Lynch got into Dune, there were so many talks of adapting Dune into a film, especially after 2001: A Space Odyssey. They were like, "Oh my God, let's do Dune."
One, of course, yeah. I mean, the space opera was hot.
It was hot. One of the earliest attempts was a filmmaker named Alejandro Jodorowsky wanted to make Dune, and he spent like he had so many plans for it. And, I mean, he envisioned Salvador Dali as the emperor, Orson Welles as Baron Harkonnen.
Oh, that's so interesting. I actually thought, because Eddie told me about this one, and I thought when he said that, the first thing I said was Salvador Dali. I was like, who was he going to be, the Baron? I would have preferred him as a Baron, to be honest.
Salvador Dali?
I don't know.
He was too skinny.
Put him in a fat suit.
Yeah, I guess. I mean,
the technology was there, Nicole.
Well, when Orson Welles would have played it, he wouldn't need the fat suit.
Oh, Orson Welles was going to be the Baron?
Yeah, that's what I said.
Oh, okay. Well, then I take it back.
Right. Yeah. So this is what...
That's solid casting.
pretty good casting. He was also going to have David Carradine as Leto Atreides.
That I don't like.
Leto, not Paul.
No.
You still don't like that? Okay. All right. No. All right. I'm sorry. it says he was going to have Gloria Swanson, who I'm sure she was going to be the Bene Gesserit that does the test on Paul. I forget her name. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so they went over budget, and it proved that Jodorowsky wanted to make like a 10-hour film. So they were like, yeah, you're not going to make this movie.
It's so funny. Like, a 10-hour film nowadays is called a Netflix series.
Yeah, but back in the day, miniseries, like, I mean, Scenes from a Marriage had just come out on Swedish television in 1977, you know, so this was, like, something that people were just realizing, oh, yeah, we could make this, like, this is a thing that we can actually take seriously. That was just not what filmmakers wanted to be doing back then, you know?
No, back then. Times have changed.
Yeah. So, then the Italian producer, Dino De Laurentiis, you know, he purchased the rights. And
is he related to Giada?
Yeah, that's his granddaughter.
Shut up, really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, that's so fucking funny. I didn't know that, and good for her. Well, wait,
De Laurentiis is a huge name in cinema history. But anyway, he actually commissioned Frank Herbert, to write a new screenplay, right, in 1978. He turned in a screenplay that was roughly about 3 hours long. He wanted Ridley Scott to direct it. And Ridley Scott wanted to split the movie into two parts.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, okay.
So pretty much Ridley Scott had to walk away after he worked on Blade Runner, something that, you know, Blade Runner ties in with both of them. Anyway, it finally got into the hands of David Lynch. After so many different directors were attached, it landed on David Lynch's lap, who, you know, would only be his third film. So, and this was, like, kind of desperate, because at that time, his, like, De Laurentiis' rights to Dune were about to expire.
Oh no, you know all about that IP. It's just like, if you're losing those rights, you got to get whatever you can out there, no matter what.
Pretty much, yeah. So, you know, after seeing The Elephant Man, De Laurentiis was like, that's my guy. It's just a weird movie to watch and be like, he's the man who's gonna make Dune. So
I've never seen Elephant Man, so I can't.
Oh my gosh, you should see that movie. It's,
I don't know.
Very good.
I had to read the book in high school. It's based off of the book, I assume, right?
Probably. I didn't know. I don't know about the book or anything like that, but it's a great film. So this was actually only one of the only David Lynch movies I had not seen, because, you know, film nerd. I really like David Lynch. So it's interesting when he has to make like a Hollywood, basic Hollywood formula, or like he's just given a Hollywood assignment. I feel like he doesn't do that well. I think he does well when he's just like, let me make my own fucking movie. And he makes something like Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart, Mulholland Drive. Just like these bizarre, could only come from David Lynch things. When he's making something that came from someone else, it doesn't work. Because he makes it so much of a David Lynch film that it's just like, this is so Lynchian that it's actually doing the source material a disservice in a way, in my opinion.
All right. I haven't read the books, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to preface that. But I would argue, when I saw these as a little kid, because that's the first time I saw these movies, this movie was as a child with my dad, because he was a fan of Dune. I don't remember hating the movie, and I don't remember thinking it was like awful. And then as time progressed and people kept talking about it, eventually the sci-fi would have a miniseries that came out. I saw the first episode with my father. He loved that series. He watched the full thing. I only watched the first episode. But, you know, and that's when I began hearing, at least from the sci-fi community, talk a lot about how awful the first Dune movie was. And I remember thinking, it's just like, I don't know, it wasn't that bad. And then I had to, obviously for this podcast, I rewatch it. And I'm just like, I stand by that. It's just like, it's not that bad. Like, maybe a disservice to the book, fine. But like, it's still, I don't know. It's an enjoyable watch, I think. It's campy. It's weird. It's you know, it's not great, but
yeah. So I don't think it's like a terrible film, but I just don't think it entirely works. You know, the thing is that when he made Dune, he made it a 4-hour film. And of course, with Hollywood standards, they really don't want anything over 2 hours. So there was a lot of cutting that happened. And I feel like that is one thing that shows in the film. It's just
Did he tell them that Ben-Hur was a thing at one point?
That was different. That was in 1959 when television was really competing with film.
When movies were competing.
Yeah, and they had to make event films. So Then he cut it down to like 3 hours and they're like, no, you got to keep cutting. And he did a bunch. And then he actually had to add in a lot of voiceovers with the new introduction that they did with the Virginia Martin character, which is right at the beginning. That kind of like helps because he's like, all right, well, none of this makes sense. So now we got to have a character talk directly to the film to make sense of everything. So I think that is really felt in the film. The editing after editing that happened, it just makes for kind of a convoluted film, at least for the first hour. Like, I kind of didn't know what was going on or who was who for a while. It took me a while to get into it. Maybe I'm just, you know, I'm not as quick to learning these things.
I might give you, I can give you who is who, but as far as what's going on, there's so much monologue, not monologue, but there's so much telling you what's happening. It's just like,
there is a lot of telling, yeah.
How are you lost?
I mean, but just because they're like telling us stuff doesn't mean that it's still like, oh, everything makes sense now.
I mean, whether or not it makes sense, I suppose, but it was, I don't, yeah, fine. Go on.
When this film came out in 1984, it was number two right behind Beverly Hills Cops. Beverly Hills Cop, sorry.
Mm-hmm. It didn't even premiere number one.
It did not. Wow. And then by the end of its run, it had only grossed $30 million, but it had a budget of $40 million. Now, it was a success.
Man, that's a $40 million movie?
$40 million,
yeah. You know what? I will say this. I thought it was more expensive.
Oh, really?
Oh. I thought so.
I thought it was more of a flop. I thought like it didn't even get half of it, but at least it almost got to recuperating its budget.
Right.
Well, it was considered a box office flop. Some people even called it the Heaven's Gate of science fiction. But it was a success in Europe and Japan. And it's actually pretty divided among people. Most of the people who actually hate it are the book lovers, and the people who like it have probably never read the book.
So I fall in that category then.
There you go.
But I'm not saying I love it. I'm just saying it's just like it's there. And look,
yeah,
it's like I remember it being so much more over the top, right? And then I guess as time going on, it's just like, oh, it's really not. Like, it's no Flash Gordon.
Well, it's not as campy, that's for sure. It has more of a muted tone to it. So much of it is so internal. You know, you hear so many of the thoughts, and there's so many people just like looking and reacting. You know, so it's not as action-y in some way, which is surprising. And it's a Lynch film. So like there's a lot of static noise and room tone. That's like his thing. He loves like, you know, gained to like 100 room tone. And that's like the soundtrack for his movies. And he likes to create atmosphere that way. There's some really interesting shots, especially, you know, when like Paul's trying to tune into, you know, what the voices or the fates are telling him. And, you know, like when it's of his hand or when it's of the planet, you know, beautiful shots. But when you put all of these elements together, for me, it just doesn't end up working. And that's why it's like, I feel like David Lynch was just trying to make something so Lynchian that he almost didn't really serve the property. And that's just kind of like, that's just my thesis statement.
Okay.
But I actually thought it was kind of, maybe it's just like that 80s-ness of it, but I thought it was somewhat over the top, especially when we present the Harkonnens.
And the Baron. The Baron. Around.
Yeah. The Baron is just so over the top in this movie. And then
that is
Sting, his Sting and, you know, the other guy.
It is a ridiculous production performance.
Yeah. Yeah. By all of them. And, you know, you compared yourself to the Baron. So I just want to get into this right now. Is this not the best and most classic example of queer coding?
Oh, you read queer on him?
So actually, I did a little research. In the book, he preys on young men. And they implied that pretty heavily in this film.
I happen to know through research that like homosexuality in the world of Dune is like very, very much forbidden.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know if that's a product of its time or if it's Frank Herbert's views, right? But I don't know. I didn't get the queer coding. The fat shaming for sure. Like I feel like fat shaming is such an easy target though. It's so easy. There's, you know, the fat cat, right? It's such an easy thing to kind of make fun of. But that's so interesting. I still didn't, I don't know if I got the queer codedness for this one.
Yeah, so that's what people of the book talk about. We're not here to talk about the book. We're here to talk about the movie. And when I saw that scene, I was confused because I didn't really understand what he was doing. But mm-hmm. the more I thought about it, the more I'm like, well, I think he pretty much, you know, drained him of his blood and took his life and all this stuff. Oh, Frank Herbert's pretty much giving us a read on people with power, which I always enjoy because, you know, fuck the rich, take them down.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people here in power because the Baron is in power. Then you have the Emperor, and then Emperor answers to some fish people.
Yeah, those fish people were weird.
Like, I don't know what. That part always confused me, and I was just, I assumed, I guess, maybe because the most recent one I saw was a New Dune, it's just like that. The pilots just like humans getting high off of the spice, and that's how they navigate space.
You know what? You know where I think we could find the answer is in the book.
And I'm not going to read that book, so it's just, I'm left to imagine what the true answer is here. There are fish people who are bossing the Emperor around, yeah. And the Emperor is now pissed at the thing. There's just a lot of shitty work
in the shadows, right? Yeah. A lot of people whispering in each other's ears and lying and deceits and false claims and traps being sent. Yeah. You know, like a lot of fucked up shit. This is like a dog eat dog world. It's fucking brutal out there in the year 10191.
You're right. And all those characters serve as foils for Leto and Paul eventually, right? When he becomes a leader of the Fremen,
who are the people who inhabit Arrakis.
Right. Which we haven't talked about Arrakis. So what are your thoughts on Arrakis here in this movie? It's desert. We know that much. We have giant giant sandworms that were puppets. You love puppets.
I do love puppets. Yeah. I mean, what is it to think? You know, it's a terrible, terrible place to live. I would never want to live on the desert. And it's interesting too because, you know, it shows just how human greed is so powerful that it could take everything from you. You know, it could take the life, and this desert planet is a product of it. And I think in one of the films they mentioned how life could have grown there, but you know, in order for spice to, they couldn't let it. You know, so it's just kind of like the stunting of the human spirit that happened. So it's just a product of greed and capitalism and like all of that stuff. So that's what I think about Dune. I would never want to, or Arrakis, I would never want to live there. And if somebody was like, oh, we want you to go rule it, I'm going to be like, I'm good. I'm going to stay here. No thanks.
You know, I wanted a desert wedding. I wanted my wedding to be in the desert.
I always thought you were pretty married to your winter wedding idea.
That was an idea, but I had several. Desert being one of them. And I was really trying to convince Eddie to do a desert wedding. We would have, you know, had it would have been a destination wedding. But I just love the idea of deserts. It's just something so... And if anything captured that the beauty of the desert, it was Denis Villeneuve's Dune, right? Where we have the women in their long, drapey outfits. It's just like, ugh, dreams. Just dreams.
Yeah.
Fantasies. Yeah. Sting was in this, by the way. Did you know this? Because I forgot that Sting was in this until Eddie reminded me when we saw him in that show, Only Murderers in the Building. And I was just like, Sting was in Dune? I don't remember. He'd be like, he's the naked guy. I was just like, that was Sting? Hmm. And lo and behold, it is still Sting.
Yeah.
So I have the important question for you, Nicole. Mm-hmm. And what does he do a better performance in this movie or in Only Murderers in the Building?
Well, is there a right or wrong answer? Or are you just asking my opinion?
That is your opinion.
Oh, okay. I guess I like it when people perform characters. So do I prefer the character he portrayed here, the character of himself? I guess the character here. It was kind of a bit much.
It was
I liked
over
it.
The top.
Yeah.
He chose chaos in his performance, and I was here for it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, no, he definitely was a little batshit cray. And mm-hmm. that's got to be a fun part to play. So
I would think so.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, the Fremen, what did you think about the portrayal of the Fremen in this film?
Honestly, there was not much to think about.
Yeah.
With them, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
Outside of the fact that they have blue eyes that were obviously created in post.
Mm-hmm.
They just seemed like kind of almost naive, right? Like kind of simple folk.
Okay.
You didn't get that? Like, it's just like, here comes Paul, and he's going to teach him how to use these weapons so we can rise up against the Harkonnen and stuff.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a fair point.
And go on. What?
No, I was waiting for you. I wasn't going to say anything.
Oh, that's it, really. No. I don't know. I that would be my thought on it. And then he is just goes to town on one of them and marries her.
Jesus.
Goes to town on one of them. You know, so this film didn't really set up atmosphere to me as well as I guess would have liked it to have. I didn't really get a sense of how the planet looked or how the planet felt or where they inhabited, like kind of all that stuff. They just kind of moved from like room to room, and I was just kind of like, okay, we're over here now. Okay, we're
yeah, they
over
were all
now.
Underground also, and I was just like, kind of just like, I don't know. We have like this beautiful, lush desert. Why are we?
That's true. I just really didn't get a sense of how anything worked, which is crazy because with a $40 million budget, but you know, it was the 80s and they were still, I don't know what it was. But I did, that was the thing too, is that nothing felt as effective as it should have been for me because the atmosphere of everything just never really clicked for me.
So interesting. In terms of the atmosphere that usually worked for me was actually when we were in Arrakis, when we were in the actual castle, right? Mm. Like that kind of atmosphere worked for me. The Emperor's throne room is another atmosphere that comes to mind. And anytime we were on Harkonnen's planet, like that had actual distinct like design elements that felt like distinct and otherworldly. And you're right, when we come to the main planet, it's just like sand, and I feel like we were just underground a lot and like lots of like caverns.
Yeah, which
was kind of, and that's the majority of the movie. That's like your second half, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So Eddie, what are your thoughts here? I mean, you saw this movie.
Yeah, I saw this movie.
Did you like this movie?
I think when I saw this, I was a kid and I was just really hungry for any sci-fi during this time period. So like Star Wars and Star Trek and when Dune came out, I got the gist of it, but I always felt that the world building was very complicated. At least how the way it was presented in the movie, like it just didn't get all the history that led up to this moment too. Yeah, I mean, like doing some research for this podcast and stuff like that. Oh, by the way, the guild navigators are human.
They're human?
They're human. They have mutated and changed through their effect of
the spice.
Yeah, they're constantly immersed in spice or spice gases.
Oh, interesting. So why are the Fremen? I mean, that deformed. Might be opening a whole different can of space worms. Yeah. Get it? Come on,
that was pretty good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the spice does spice does have that effect. It does change. It does provides people, opens up their minds and explores mental possibilities, mental powers,
mm-hmm.
As well as effects on aging and physical.
Oh, interesting. So
keeps people living longer.
Yeah, there's just so much to the books too that like you can't really put into a 2.5-hour movie and just do the whole book. The one thing that this movie did make me want to do is read the book because I was just like, maybe this will all make more sense if I read the book.
Really? Do you want to read Dune?
Maybe.
Okay.
I like reading.
I don't want to read.
That's fair. It just doesn't call to you.
No,
like
I'm actually very, very much interested in the book. Like I said, doing some research here, it's like Frank Herbert's use of religion in the novel, especially Islamic. There's a lot of Islamic terms in the book, a lot of words and kind of religious and cultural experiences that get expressed in this story.
Interestingly enough, the word jihad was dropped in David Lynch's movie. I remember hearing it. I was just like, oh, interesting. That's a interesting terminology to use.
Mm-hmm.
But Eddie had already told me about like the, I don't, is it appropriation, right? He, you know, Frank Herbert, I'm assuming, is a white guy, right?
He's a white guy, and and there are some people that do talk about appropriation, but then they others that talk about
inspiration
or celebrating these cultures.
Oh, okay.
Or the opportunity, because one author puts it that he states, like, looking at Frank Herbert having that white privilege. So when you're able to speak of other people's culture or faith in your stories, people are like, oh my God, this is so like, so intercultural. It's like, this is amazing. Let's publish it. But when you're that person of that faith, yeah, and that cultural experience, and you try to get your writing out there, people just don't understand.
Mm. I mean, that's true.
So there is that level of, you know, bias. But you know, there's some mixed feelings. But what I've read and heard from other podcasts on this subject is that most people felt like it was somehow celebrating of these cultures, or recognizing or utilizing, you know, their story. But at the end of the day, too, it's kind of like a white savior story too.
It is, yeah.
You know, so it still presents this way. You know, coming in here, the outsider comes in and he gives this knowledge to the tribal people, and mm-hmm. they take that and they make him the Messiah and rise up. Mm-hmm. You know,
absolutely.
So,
that is something that I actually had more in my head watching the 2021 film.
Yes, it's the white Messiah. The white Messiah trope is much more present in the 2021 film, although technically I guess it'll be more present in the 2023 sequel.
Oh yeah, true. Yeah, well, they planted the seeds for, I guess, that.
Right, they're there. I mean, you know, it was basically, we have a white chosen one, guys. Surprise, surprise. And it's played by Timothée Chalamet.
Is that how you say it?
Chalamet.
Oh.
Chalamet.
I thought it was. Yeah, I thought it was Timothée Chalamet.
Oh, maybe I. Maybe I was.
You know what? Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't know. Should we?
Timothy.
Yeah, Timothée Chalamet. I don't. Should we confirm this, or does it matter?
I don't know. What's he gonna do? Sue us?
And then, like, he's gonna say, cut to 2 days from now. We're served papers.
He's gonna say, "I will never be on this podcast."
But yeah. So, 2021. This movie was supposed to come out last year, and it got delayed because of the pandemic. And the filmmaker, Denis Villeneuve, he absolutely would not budge on nothing but a theatrical release. You know, he takes his work very seriously. And so this film did not come out for a whole year because of that. And the hype has been real. Everyone's just been really excited. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're kind of deprived for things like this these days. We don't get too many exciting things that people want to go to the movies for. And the hype, I think, delivered, because this is so far the... Dune had the best opening for a 2021 Warner Brothers title and for his entire career. So this film is the same length as the first Dune, like we said, but it just takes place within the first half of the book, right? So we learn about the worlds, albeit very differently from how we do it in the first film, which we should talk about now. And then it ends with him coming across the Fremen and then choosing to live with them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty.
He decides, simply, but yeah. I'm going to harness desert power, which I thought was such a corny line.
Yeah, well, the worst line was the one after it, which was, "This is only the beginning." I literally was like, "No, you're not ending it like this." Anyway, so with the David Lynch film, we have a character addressing the camera, pretty much saying, you know, hey, stories are complicated, and this is how this one goes.
I am your narrator through the stars.
Yeah. And then we just kind of are introduced to a bunch of different people, and we learn right away, actually, that the Emperor is conspiring against this House of Atreides. So we learn about all the people who are against Atreides before we meet Atreides. In this film, we immediately meet the House of Atreides, and we actually, the conspirator, sorry, the conspiring that happened to Atreides and the fact that they were pretty much put, you know, in a trap and set up to fail is as much of a surprise intended as a surprise to the audience as it is to the House of Atreides. Whereas that's correct. The first thing we learn in the Lynch film, right? So two right. completely different approaches.
Yes.
Which did you think was more effective in your the way that they told this story cinematically? Because we don't know how it happens in the book.
Denis Villeneuve.
I think so too.
That version was much more when it comes for like the medium, right? Like mm-hmm. instead of telling us up front that a character is going to get betrayed, let's see them get betrayed, surprise the audience, and then we. And I don't even think Denis Villeneuve gives you like out front, like in one sitting, like why this happened. Like it's still given out little by little, like why this betrayal is happening.
Yes, absolutely.
And what I love about it is that it gives you enough clues through the point of realization that you, the audience, is figuring this out
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
That this is you've been set up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is like a setup.
Yeah. Like when we first meet the people in Harkonnen, that one scene where it's like, why would they do this to us? Why would they take Arrakis away from us? And he's just like, right. The Emperor is a jealous guy. And we never even meet the Emperor. We just hear these little things. Yeah, so like Eddie said, there's so much planting that at the end, we figured it all out by the time they did. And they're like, well, fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And this gives us an opportunity to build a relationship with these characters. So we get to actually understand Paul more. Because we hear a lot about Paul in the 1984 film before we meet him. And then when we meet him, you know, like Patrick Stewart's character of Gurney, is just like we meet him in that fight sequence and he's mm-hmm. just kind of thrown into situation after situation. And, you know, you kind That's of true, yeah. feel the same way he did where it's just like, what the fuck's going on
Why?
Here? You know,
what is happening?
I
must rise up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in this film, you know, the first thing that we see after he wakes up from his dreams is his relationship with his mother. Right. The most important relationship that he has, I think, in terms of the whole film, how much she's actually setting him up to be someone. Right.
Yeah.
Actually, I think they
did a good job of kind of
he's a messiah, like the messiah. But what was the term called again?
I can't find it. It's like the. Savuk.
I'll find it.
But I think they did a good job of like kind of balancing out though his adoration of both parents, right? Like he had two good parents in this film.
He had
a very, you know, I mean, Oscar Isaac, and I don't know this actress's name.
Rebecca Ferguson.
Should I know her from anything?
She was in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. She was in The White Queen, Mission Impossible movies, Dr. Sleep.
Oh, was she a vampire?
I think she was. She was the leader of the cults.
She was the energy. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Right, fine. Sorry,
so she was good. Yeah.
But yeah, I thought she was great on screen too.
So, you know, it's interesting because this was an all-star cast and there were moments where I was kind of taken out of the story because of certain choices like Dave Bautista and Jason Momoa, especially like with the great reveal of Jason Momoa, you know, like he comes out and he's in his full guard and then like Timothy Chalamet is like running after him and then he like takes off his helmet and he's like, oh, hey, you know, and it's like it's Duncan, Idaho. And it's just like, so distracting.
Oh, interesting.
I loved it.
I actually, in defense of Jason Momoa, I think he was the levity, the kind of this film needed, to be totally honest.
Oh, his performance was fine, but I guess it's just it's like I'm in a story and then it's those moments where I'm like, oh, right, this is a Hollywood movie, you know, it just takes me out of the story.
But if you were in the 1950s, you know, all the movies would have had the same stars also back then.
This is true, but these movies would not have taken themselves as seriously as Dune did.
I think they were probably taking themselves just as seriously back then as Denis Villeneuve does take himself now. I will say Villeneuve.
I don't know about that. Villeneuve is clearly trying to make art here. And like these old Hollywood films, even though they ended up making art, and I do think Dune is art, they didn't take themselves as serious. This film takes itself incredibly seriously.
I think it does. I would agree. And I've the How many? I think he's only made like what, 4 or 5 films, maybe. I think something, right?
Not
a high number
in America. Yeah.
I thought America's only like 3 or 4, right?
No, he's made a few other films, but he's made short films. He's made films in other languages, but in America, yeah, he made Sicario, Arrival, The Enemy.
Oh, Sicario! I keep forgetting that one. Okay.
And then Blade Runner.
Yeah, no, the movie just takes its time. Like your first act is basically the setup of House Atreides going off to Arrakis. And the second act is the betrayal. Third act is Paul running for his life, basically, right? If you had to divide this movie into acts, mm-hmm. and it ends, obviously, with him finding safety with the Fremen people.
Fremen. Yeah.
And throughout the whole movie, even though she is not in it that much, the one that we see like here and there a lot in his visions is Zendaya. She plays his future wife. And what? Uh-huh. Is that wrong?
I mean, yeah.
I forgot her name. Like Shuli?
Channy.
Channy.
Or Shani or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't have to do spoilers like that. We don't have to say things like future wife or, you know.
Oh. And I don't know. I think it was pretty much there that they're going to end up together.
Continue.
It's in his visions. Although I will say this about his visions, they're not necessarily they're not prophecies, right? They're just like, I think they're more like probability.
Mm.
Like this is what potentially might happen and stuff, and he's gaining the information as he can from it. So
yeah.
And those visions that I'm talking about, like those are they replace like the inner monologues that we get a lot in David Lynch's movie, right? So that's another way that this movie differentiates itself a lot.
Yes.
This movie chooses to go the visual route where David Lynch's story went like the oral route.
Yeah. And well, we spend mm-hmm. a lot more time actually with like Paul in these, like, I feel like he's not really alone a lot in the David Lynch film, but he's alone a lot. We kind of get like almost like how isolated he is externally, but also internally. You know, he, because of his mother, you know, mm-hmm. making the Bene Gesserit visions and stuff happen to him, you know, and he like freaks out later because he feels like he's a freak in the way that he was changed. And this is something that typically happens to women, right? But she wanted it to happen to her child, and she wanted a son, which is why she was concubine to Leto. So he is clearly different, and he clearly does feels different, and he knows he's different. And he's, so we spend so much with him, and with just like seeing things through his eyes, literally, but also figuratively. And I felt like the quiet that we get to spend with him while he's listening to his thoughts and while he's listening to the earth and when he's just wanting to learn, you know, learning about Arrakis before he goes there, was also really effective in terms of world building and character building.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's also, I felt like I didn't really get the whole he's possibly the Messiah aspect as much in the 1984 one as I did in the 2021 film. You know, this quiet, contemplative figure that we spent so much time with is just more believable. And you understand, okay, there's something different about him, you know, mm-hmm. and like he's different and he's going to actually bring change, you know, other than the fact, yeah, he has visions and yeah, obviously that's different. But he himself as a person, as a character, is different from everyone around him, even though his father is a very honorable man and the whole family is kind of almost flawless. In a weird way, I'm like, do these people have any flaws? You know,
I don't disagree with you, except for the fact that like him being different. I would say like him and his father would be like the only two different characters. They are the exceptions to everybody around them, right? His father included, right? Where everyone is quick to the sword, and to attack when they feel threatened, like even for like a second. It is both Paul and Leto who always stay cool, calm, and collected and are using kind of diplomacy almost to get ahead. And that's part of the reason why Leto... We see in this movie much more why Leto is a threat to the Empire versus David Lynch's movie.
Oh, you think so? Because I felt like in the Lynch film, we had so many times where they were like, wow, you're a great man. Oh, you
yeah.
Like in the 1984 film, they said, you chose your men over the spice. Wow. He's a great man. But nobody said anything like that to Leto in this film.
We didn't have to, but because we just saw it. And you would see it, and then we will also literally see it in how the characters act around him. Specifically, the ecologist, for example, right? Like, that's... So, again, it's not... We didn't literally need to hear it. It's more...
Well, no, yeah. Well, I was disagreeing with you and how you said you didn't get that from the 1980 film because they were literally telling us that.
Yeah, you heard it, but, like, here we're seeing it.
Yeah, like, it was more jammed down our throats in that one. I mean, I think seeing is always way more effective than being told, you know, which is why I think the 1984 film... Even though it was telling us so much information, yet there's so much confusion happening because it's like, oh my God, I'm just taking in so much confusion. It's like when you go see a musical, right? They say, you know, make sure you have themes and variations because there's only so much new music a person can take in and register it, right? That's why reprises happen in shows. Mm. You know, like a person can only take in so much new stuff. So Dune is just like, it's just the first film. It's just throwing so much shit on you. And in a book, you could read it and you could put it down. You could go back and reread it. But a film is meant to be seen in one sitting, right?
Right.
This is how the medium was intended. So there's only so much that you can do without overwhelming people.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1984, I did feel a little overwhelmed. Not so much in 2021, which is really good. Even though it was a little longer, did you feel that the length felt? Did you feel like this film felt long? Did you feel like it lasted a little too long? Did you feel like it had pacing issues?
The only time I felt the movie felt too long was in the first act.
Okay,
I think for me that's the one that felt the longest, like leaving, his home planet to get to Atreides. No. Akron. Oh, I already lost. To get to Dune.
You know? Oh, really?
That would... Yeah, I think the first act for me is the one that felt the longest. Mm. And it's not until they get to the planet, the desert planet, where I think the movie Arrakis, thank you, that they start picking up the pace. And that's also... I think it's also around the end of the first act where we finally start see a bit of the bad guys more. And that's when you start getting like those really, really like intimidating scenes with the Baron. And like, I mean that if I had to like the movie, when I had to praise it is I think they made the Baron such a disturbing character. Like his creep factor is just up just based off of like the camera work, the lighting and just the performance, you know, like the Baron became like one of my favorite points of this movie.
Yeah, they kind of, the less is more definitely worked, you know. They hinted at him and they gave you brief scenes and every scene you got was like, ew, gross. And like, what a bastard. Yeah. Betraying the Bene Gesserit and just like lying in filth and whatnot. Or whatever that black thing was.
Yeah, Skarsgård, right? Skarsgård?
Yes, Skarsgård, yes.
Skarsgård.
I didn't mind that, actually. I think that in order for you to care about, you know, their betrayal, you do have to spend time with characters and you have to world build at a good pace. So I didn't mind the first hour. I guess right after everyone died and we were like, you know, the Paul and his mother were bouncing around trying to find refuge. That to me was around the time where I was like, okay, how much longer is this movie? But in total, I felt like a lot of things were really effective. When we first see... I'm trying to remember the sandworm's name because it had a name. But when we first see that first interaction with the sandworm and, you know, Leto's like, what I care about is... What?
It just looks like a giant butthole, no?
You couldn't talk about. You're totally missing other things.
You didn't think the sandworm looked like a giant anus?
No.
Oh,
not at all.
Anyway, that whole interaction where, you know, it's like, all right, we need to get these men out of here. And like, no, we have a protocol for it. And then the protocol fails and then they all accept their death. But he comes in and he saves them. And like, you know, and it's coming. It's that ticking time bomb. The way that they handled that in Dune, where they're just watching it from a distance versus being down on the ground and like having, you know, like I felt the anxiety and the suspense there. And I thought that was really well executed, a really well done action sequence.
Yeah, actually, I will say that also about these action sequences in this movie. You know how I was complaining, I think, not that long ago about, like, holding the action? Like, hold the shot a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. I got a movie finally where it's just like, all right, great. We're not cutting every second on some of these sequences. And it makes it's such a nice breath of fresh air.
Oh, 100%. It's always really refreshing, too, when you watch a movie and you're pretty sure a character is going to be okay, but they throw him in a situation that you actually question whether or not everything is going to be okay. Mm-hmm. That's just good filmmaking.
Yeah,
when you actually feel the anxiety and stuff. I thought that it was devastating to see the betrayal, although it wasn't as effective that it was Dr. Yue, who was the traitor in this one, because we only saw him 2 times before. I mean, this movie had gone on for an hour and a half, and the traitor I only saw twice before. That, I thought, was a flaw.
Right. Okay. And I learned from my friend who has read the book that, like, the betrayal is even more important because, and they go into this a little bit in the
1984
original one. He goes through, like, some hardcore training to not cause a betrayal. And it was House Harkonnen that, like, kind of broke his conditioning in order for this betrayal to happen. So we didn't get that. So, yeah, that's a fair critique in this movie because otherwise it's just like, you know,
yeah,
you got betrayed.
Yeah, they did kind of sacrifice that bit of world building because they threw that in the 1984 thing. Mm-hmm. And it's there on his forehead in this film. But, you know, that's just kind of like an Easter egg for people who know what it's about. And
exactly.
I think that's actually really interesting. And that would have, to me, been even more effective towards the betrayal had I known that, I think.
Right.
So maybe in that beginning, a scene could have been cut out for that to have happened. Because, like, just like in Dune, when she's, like, looking at the contenders to be housekeepers and he's there with her and, you know, and she's like, that's how they get that information where they're, like, looking at each other and it's like, oh, he can't lie to me because of this. They could have thrown that in there, you know, so.
They could have, you're right.
It was a little.
That would have been a good place to throw it. Eddie, any thoughts on anything that we've said?
When you talk about the first act, too, I like that they slowed the pace. Like, it was a little slow, but it give you time to experience the world of Caladan, where the House of Atreides is, and it's an ocean planet, right? So here you have the ruler of the ocean planet going to a desert to be the steward of a desert world.
Okay.
So you have that play. When you have this world of life compared to this world that looks so barren, but as Paul proceeds to explore and learn about Dune, you begin to see that there is more life there than you realize. And not only within the worms and the people there, but the sand itself has the opportunity or the potential to give life, you know, to the universe and what it represents, you know, to everyone. So definitely I enjoyed that. I picked up a lot on the kind of the male relationships that Paul had in his life. You had Duncan, you had Gurney, and you had his dad. And they all had, like, moments where they kind of, like, reached out to him physically. You know, there was something very tender and very, like, brotherly or loving in how they always reached out to Paul. You know, so, I mean, that whole scene was totally different when we were introduced to Duncan, how in the 84 movie, it's just a handshake. It's a very stern, masculine handshake, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But then you have young Paul, who's a teenager. It's like, this is one of his, like, role models. This is, like, the guy that trains him. Run up and give him, like, a big bear hug, too. And Gurney gives the tough lessons. But then there are moments where he sees Paul and he puts his hand on his shoulder. And that tender moment between father and son when Paul's like, I don't know if I can be your successor to you, like, to rule. You know, I don't know if that's like my destiny. And he says, well, whatever it is, the most important thing is that you're my son.
Yeah.
And I just felt that was just powerful.
Yeah. Ugh, I mean, how often do we see shit like that in fucking movies, too? It's like,
it's
never.
Actually, yeah. I mean, Eddie just say that it is true. And it's, I mean, very different from obviously the original, the first Dune movie, where it's the hyper masculine energy is there. right? And if you were to ask, it's just like, which one of these two, like, you get me the man from House Atreides, put him in the line from both movies, and you say, it's like, and you ask, it's just like, who's probably more toxic? You say the David Lynch one's probably, you know? Mm. And these are clearly much more sentimental. Although I would argue, though, and I'm just playing devil's advocate here, where Nicole mentioned, it's just like, well, I don't know, they're just a little too perfect in this family, right? I would kind of say it's just like that kind of falls a little bit here. But, yeah, you know, it's a movie. You know,
yeah,
what
do
you...
Well, it's also interesting
I think it's good portrayal to present in men, though.
I thought the men, and it's like it was a interesting role reversal, too, because the men were all very warm and the women were rather cold. At least the women figures, the Bene Gesserit is in particular. And
I love, by the way, the costume design for the Bene Gesserit,
yeah,
in this
great
one.
Loved it.
Like, just like, it looks so cool on mm-hmm. camera.
But they also wield way more control. Mm-hmm. And they're more powerful, you know? So it was interesting, too, because colder figures that yield a lot of power, you know, that's, to me, that's it's a reversal. You know, the men are warmer, more, you know, there you have that more attentive physical relationship with. So I appreciated that.
Yeah. Actually, Denis Villeneuve wanted women to play a bigger role in this movie than I think even in the book. And he actually gender swapped a role to have it
the one that
by a
Max
female,
van
ecologist.
Sydow played in the original. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That one. Yeah. So, and you know, I guess, and props to this one too. Like, the 1984 movie was all, I think it was all white, right? Like, I don't remember seeing people of color.
Mm-hmm.
This one, you have a much more diverse cast. Still suffering from the white savior complex. I don't think you could change that off of the source material, though. But the casting, I think the casting for, like, the Fremen people, for example, I think it felt much more organic. You know?
Why?
For, I don't know. Like, I guess changing visually not being white, I think, right? Like, they look like other compared to, like, our main characters.
Okay.
And I think I think, for this story, that kind of helps to, like, kind of, you have to see a little bit of a difference here from, because in 1984 Dune, they're all white, so it's just like, I can't tell the difference of who's who. At least here I could visually tell a difference.
Well, visually their costumes
also.
Costume
aside, but when they're all wearing, because in the battle sequence they're all wearing, like, kind of these Power Rangers outfits, you know? So
yes,
it's going to be hard to tell.
And
those are, like, premonitions that this kid's having, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, it did a good job in, showing me, you know, okay, these are clearly people that are different from our main character, but it definitely made the white savior thing just feel way more apparent. I was like, okay, everybody who's not a main character, or at least part of this flawless House of Atreides, is not white.
Mm-hmm.
Or Harkonnen. And I just, you know, that's when I realized maybe the themes that we're supposed to actually get from Frank Herbert's Dune or from the text. But that was when I was most aware of it. You know, in a weird way, David Lynch's film was, you know, nicely, everyone was white, so everyone was kind of equal.
That's fair.
That wasn't the case here. And I guess, I don't know, because of their costumes, which are so, you immediately think Islam, and they're in the desert. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, what am I trying to get from this? Like, I have to digest it some more in order to figure out what it means in my head.
But I just want to point out, though, they're not vilified. In fact, quite the opposite, right?
Uh-huh.
Hang on. I think in the new Dune, they're kind of almost Jason Momoa's character Duncan, he says just like they have so much power, like they are a force to be reckoned with, that we, the colonists, aren't, we don't know about them. And you know, it's Paul who's going to, like, figure out how to harness that desert power.
I hope I didn't come off as like I was saying that they were being vilified. I'm trying to understand where they're going and what story. Like, are they aware of the white savior thing? Is that part of it? Is that what they're trying to say?
The whole idea too is Frank, when Frank Herbert doesn't really give a skin tone to any of the characters in the book. And no, we're not talking about the book, but in the book itself, I mean, Paul was referenced, I think, some point as having olive skin in the book.
Gasp.
Also, Paul was young. I don't know how old
Timothy Chalamet
is playing, but Paul was 15 in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, when he first gets to Dune. So, but yeah, I mean, you do have that white messiah. It just happens to be that situation here.
Yeah, I'm curious. Although to your point, Nicole, I don't know. I'm curious to see, like, do they feed into this or do they figure out a way to make, I don't know, Shuli and Zendaya much more present.
Yeah, I think her name is Chani.
Uh-huh. Chani, which that reminds me. That brings me up to another more important point that I just want to complain about. You know, the studio really marketed the shit out of this movie with Zendaya front and center.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she's like, kind of all over it. She comes in every 2 seconds.
Yeah, but she's in it for like a grand total, I think, of like 8 minutes of screen time in this film.
Well, you know, I mean, she'll be in the next one for sure.
And I just find it interesting, though, because on Variety, like, the studios are saying, like, some of the quotes are saying, it's like, oh, we're about to find out if Timothy Chalamet and Zendaya are going to bring in the box office mojo. It's just like, why is this on Zendaya? Like, this is much more on Oscar Isaacs. This is much more on Timothy Chalamet.
I agree.
This is much more,
to be fair,
on Jason Momoa.
Hannibal Lecter was only in Silence of the Lambs for like 15 minutes and he won the Oscar. So it doesn't really matter.
I mean, that's fair. But was the movie, I don't know how the movie was marketed. Was it marketed as a Jodie Foster thing or an Anthony
Hopkins
feature?
They both were in it. I mean, a lot of people think that he's a major part of the film before they see it. And then they see it and they're like, oh, the villain is Buffalo Bill. Anyway, I want to read you something. As a foreigner who adopts the ways of a desert-dwelling people and then leads them in a military capacity, Paul Atreides bears many similarities to T.E. Lawrence.
Who is that?
Do you ever hear of a film, Lawrence of Arabia?
Yes.
So apparently, Lawrence of Arabia was a huge influence on Frank Herbert. Lawrence of Arabia, it won the Oscar when it came out in 1962. Fucking huge movie. Beautiful movie, all shot within the desert, right? But T.E. Lawrence, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
he's a British man, and he went. He became renowned for his role in the Arab Revolt.
Interesting. Look at that. All right. Well, now we just learned something new there.
Yeah.
So, I guess it's not as offensive as, like, Tom Cruise in The Last Samurai.
But it's interesting because it's... Even though it does take religious tones, the influence of a major historical figure, too, it just makes me wonder, you know, okay, this is a white guy writing, you know, pretty much taking the story of another white guy that was his contemporary and his role in, you know, militarizing a country. So mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering in what direction it's going. I've never read the books and I don't know what to take from it as to whether or not is this just like kind of like a nice metaphor that just so happens to be. You know, they're like a Jesus or Muhammad thing. I don't know. I have to wait for the other films. And I guess I still have to think about it because I only saw this film last night. So,
yeah, you're right. And you know what? And while we're at it, why wasn't Shuli? They could have just made Shuli a guy. It didn't have to be Zendaya.
You keep saying Shuli, and I'm like, who are you talking about?
I know. Yeah.
What's
no
her name?
What talking about.
Wait, who is it? Is that Shuli? What's her name? Shumi?
Chani.
Oh, Shani. I'm sorry. I will say this when I watch that movie. I just know her as Zendaya. It's Zendaya.
Yeah, and Zendaya. Yeah, let's just say it, Zendaya. Yeah. I mean, well, that's the thing, too. Unfortunately, this is a weird case, I guess, in where race matters. Because I only ask these things because of the fact that the Atreides house is white, right? And because if history has shown, or at least white savior complexes has been a thing. And you know, it's simple because of that. If they casted someone who wasn't white in it, I probably wouldn't be thinking this. So
that's true. Oh my God. What if like House Atreides was like all like Asian, for example?
Ooh.
Right. And then what would that, I don't know.
Well, I definitely wouldn't have the idea of white savior pop into my head. And I would actually pay more attention to, I would think of it more as either an allegory or a metaphor. For maybe religion, the colonization of America, you know, because these were also mm-hmm. thoughts that I had in my head. I was like, oh, so they're like natives and, you know, were the assholes who forced their way in and took their goods and forced them into the shadows.
I kept thinking of the Iraqi war.
Yeah, see, so it works in a lot of ways, you know, but because of the fact that there has been quite simply, you know, a lot of white supremacy and white power over the ages, the fact that they're white people, just it just makes me question. I'm like, is it ignorant to white people's power, or is it commentating on white supremacy and white power?
Yeah. So, you know, and I agree with you, which reminds me. So I do remember thinking this.
I feel like a lot of cast wasn't white, though.
I think it's not enough for me to not have this thought of. And that's the thing. Like, it is what it is. Is it making a commentary, or is it ignorant to what it's doing? How do you feel? Do you think it's ignorant to the fact that they're like, oh, yeah, no, we just so happen to put the House of Atreides all white and every other person is either Asian, like the doctor.
The doctor, right?
Or the Fremen, who are either Spanish or black.
Which I would argue the doctor being Asian might be problematic. The only thing that could be even more problematic if he was like an Indian person. I feel like because like Indian doctors are a thing. And just I feel like at least they didn't go that far, but I don't know. I didn't think anything of the Asian doctor. We're really getting into race.
So yeah, but my question was, do you think that the film was making a commentary on white supremacy and white power, or do you think it was ignorant to that?
So I actually do think it was making a little bit of a commentary on it, especially because I kept equating it to like the Iraqi-Afghanistan war. Mm. It was more so the Iraqi war, where we were just there for the oil, the spice, right? But
good point.
I don't know who are the, because I feel like Americans are technically more so House Harkonnen. So I don't know who is House Atreides, right? Because in the Iraq War, I feel like history will put us as very much the bad guys. We were the invaders.
Yeah.
Right? And sorry if I am offending anyone out there who thinks otherwise, but I feel like history is going to judge us not in a very positive light because of this war. Therefore, my question then becomes, like, who is House Atreides? I think the House Harkonnen there would have been, like, America.
Yeah.
I don't know who are the good guys here that would have come in to, like, kind of help the Iraqis.
This is when it's fantasy.
Right. I know. I guess, yes. But I don't know. I think it's just, like, House Atreides. Maybe the problem there is that making this family, like, too perfect.
How is this family too perfect? I don't get it, because I feel like we didn't get enough time with the family.
They're so nice. They're genuinely.
Well,
like,
I mean,
just
we spent an hour
so nice.
With them, and
Oscar Isaac
there wasn't
is just
many
so
flaws.
Beautiful.
The only flaw I could take is that she kind of just forced him into this whole Bene Gesserit thing without consulting the dad, or I don't know. Maybe he was too much of like a hands off dad. Maybe from that. That's like literally the only flaw that was presented. He's understanding. He's providing. He cares for his son. Like, his son is his main motivator. And it's the same thing for the woman.
He cares for his
name
people.
I can't remember. Yeah, he cares for his people. Like,
Jessica.
Fuck the spice.
Her name is Jessica.
Thank you. Lady Jessica. You know, he won't sacrifice his people for the spice. Right? So, like, to me, that's also just like, oh, wow, I wish people in power would make decisions like that. So in that case, it's just like they're almost too good to be true. Right. So this is, which is why they die.
Yeah. And I think even I feel like even like Oscar Isaac's death felt so noble. Right. Like, you know what I mean? Like when he dies and he's going to take that one last bite to like try to kill the bad guy and he'll take down everyone with him. And he knows he's going to die too. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like Eddie, I don't want you to think that, like, for me at least, this isn't like a critique, like a heavy, heavy critique. Like, I'm not saying this is like, oh, this is a terrible. Like, I'm just saying it's like,
and
but it is something that you'll notice.
Nothing wrong with critiques. Nothing's
perfect.
No.
But I think also at the same time, though, me being critical is not me saying that I didn't like it. I'm just saying it's just like, but it is something that is there. The House Atreides also looks like much better when you compare it to House Harkonnen and the Baron, who's just literally shot to look evil and sinister, and you see his all the conniving and backstabbing, right?
Yeah.
So it even makes Oscar Isaac's Leto look much more pleasant. It's just like, oh, what a great leader compared to what they had before, right? Mm. So it's just like, it's just those little things in filmmaking. And, you know, keep in mind, I feel like on some level, like filmmaking and storytelling in general, like you have to sometimes come down to these kind of broad strokes painting sometimes for the general audience's sake.
I see. Okay. Interesting. That's an interesting closing statement on that.
I have one last question, actually, since we're about to close, because we are going long, just like these two movies.
Oh. Yeah, well, there's a lot to say, unfortunately, so...
You it's didn't be see this episode. On the big screen.
I did not see this on the big screen, no.
Do you think you missed out?
Yeah, I mean, well, when I was sitting there and I was watching it on my 65-inch TV, I was like, man, you know what I'm missing is surround sound.
Okay, yeah.
So and popcorn. The experience, you know, of a huge screen, right? Because, like, 65-inch doesn't even do, like, I was like, no, this needs to be bigger, right? Movie theater bigger, yeah. Or my projector bigger. You know, I need to have the sound surrounding me. There was a time where I had to, like, tell Alexa to cut off my lights because I was like, I want to see the worm. Oh, man, I wish I could remember its name. Yeah, I definitely, absolutely think I would have benefited okay. from it.
But you chose not to.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, like, it was free on HBO Max.
So. No, I was just asking, though, because I got to see this in the big screen, and I'm actually glad I did, although... Had my friend not been pressuring me to go see this in the big screen, I probably would have just watched it on HBO Max too. Aww. And then when it was done, I also probably would have regretted it.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
I
would have told you all about it.
Yeah. So yeah, Eddie. I think Eddie did want to see this one in the big screen, so we would have gone. We got to see it in the IMAX, so it is. It looks great, and I, you know, the Denis Villeneuve movies that I have seen tend to look. They have like a style. I was wondering if you thought that like his filmmaking lacks soul, which is something I hear you say a lot about Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, so the Hans Zimmer score more than anything is what made me think of Christopher Nolan when I saw this.
But, and I hated that Hans Zimmer score.
I know, I'm so
I think that was my
it.
Least
I'm so it
was
fucking
I was
over it.
That was my least favorite part about this movie, if I had to be very honest. I think the music was just too on the nose.
Yeah, it's just too Hans Zimmer. Like he doesn't do anything creative. I'm just not into it.
I like Hans Zimmer some of his stuff, but okay.
Yeah, so I definitely think hop off what?
Pop off on like hating.
Oh, pop off. I thought you said hop off. I was like, what?
No.
Anyway, very much reminded me of Christopher Nolan. Sometimes I did think I was watching a Christopher Nolan thing. And that's the thing. These are two very visionary filmmakers. Both of them.
I too felt the same way.
Yeah, it's just like you look at it and you're just kind of like stunned by it. Mm-hmm. Did it not have heart, though? So I haven't actually seen many other films by this filmmaker.
You haven't seen Arrival?
No, I have not.
I feel like you would like Arrival because that one, I think at the end of the day, has so much, I don't know, maybe the story has a lot of, like, heart. Mm. Which is shocking for a sci-fi movie about aliens, but I think it
What
does.
Do you mean? How what? Is that shocking?
Oh, I guess it's true. Like some of the best ones do. E.T., Encounters of the Third Kind,
yeah.
Any other
Spielberg movies? You mean?
yeah. Well, so there we go. That's the visionary.
There's others, but I just can't think of it right now. I guess more so on this film, I kept asking, why did he feel that this, you know, like why did he was this a passion project for him? Why did he really want this movie to be made? And what was he trying to bring to this that David Lynch didn't do across and that needed to be done? And I do think it was more of kind of like almost this religious, spiritual part of it that we didn't get in Dune 1984, at least effectively done. So I think he intentionally tried to make a quiet film. I think he intentionally mm-hmm. tried to make a film that was more with, you know, like that lingered on moments instead of rushing it, not as much story driven. And I do think it was effective. However, I know that I'm going to, in a couple of days, get a sense of coldness from this film because that's just how I feel in general when I don't have characters that burst off of the screen for me, right? I always have mm-hmm. this feeling of like, oh, like the characters, they're not talking to me anymore. They don't live within me anymore.
Interesting.
And that's
okay.
definitely something that I think visually it's going to be in my head for a while. Character-wise, not so much. This is based on a really heavy book. In terms of, you know, character and plot, and having not read the book, I don't know if that's a shame or if that's just kind of like, well, that's Dune for you. Dune doesn't actually care as much about his characters as much of his story. I don't know. And I don't know if that's a he did a disservice or not, but as just a film, that is the one thing that I guess I will say is that I know that after a while, when I think back on the film, I'm going to feel a distance to these characters.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like how I feel with Wes Anderson movies. So,
right. We've spoken about this outside of the podcast.
Yeah, it's so visually stunning. And then I'm just like, oh, mm-hmm. right. But do I remember anything about who they were? You know? So.
Do you think this film was needed?
I'm sure the Dune fans appreciate it. I think the reputation of Dune is going to change because of it. Before, I think Dune mm-hmm. was just kind of, you know, for people who even knew that it was a movie, they like rolled their eyes and was like, oh, you know, that David Lynch flop. Now it's going to be taken seriously. I think people, there's such hype around it that people who wouldn't normally indulge in something like this will be indulging in it.
Mm-hmm.
People might even read the book. And I think that it has the potential of becoming more indebted into our pop culture because of it. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. You might hear like people making references to it, you know, like more often, you know, like if we remembered some of these fucking terms that I can't remember, we might be calling each other these things like the Messiah or whatever. So I think that was it needed? Jeez. As a person who's never read the book and just enjoyed the movie. Yeah. Okay. Sure. Mm-hmm. What about you?
I think I came out of this movie thinking it's just like, yeah, I think this movie was needed, if only because I didn't remember much of the David Lynch movie, to be honest. And when I saw this, it felt fresh. It felt different. And sometimes I remember some of the beats that would happen. And sometimes I was just like, oh, okay, this still feels new.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes that's all you could ask for, especially for an adaptation. Like I said, I'm not an avid fan of, I never read Dune. My only real connection to Dune is that my father really loved the books. He was so on the film, and he loved the sci-fi miniseries when it came out in like 2000, 2002, whatever. So I would say like, so I guess the way I say it, yeah, it was needed because I feel like if my dad was alive right now, he would be watching it several times in theaters and on HBO Aww. Max. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
he would let the theater that he'd be rewatching it at home. And I feel like I can like speak to that on my dad. Like he would have loved this movie. And, you know, I think it's just like, all right, so maybe this is a film that fans did need.
Mm.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it was a bold choice for the movie to kind of end where it did, because does it feel to you like a complete story as it is right now?
Yes.
It did. Wow, it did not feel like a complete story for me. However, I also did see the David Lynch movie, so it's
yeah.
just like, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a little bold to end it where it did, because I think the ending did feel a little anticlimactic, despite the fact that I did like the fight sequence. But the reason I thought it was bold is because like they didn't know if they were going to get a chance to finish this story. So I just think it's bold of Denis Villeneuve to say, it's just like, well, I'm only going to give you half, and if you guys don't take it, oh well, that's sad.
I see what you mean, and like
goodbye Hollywood.
But it doesn't kill me. I'm not like, oh my God, what happens next? No, you can't leave it like that. Like, if
no, you're right.
If there isn't another film, I got what I got from it, and I'm okay.
I see what
you know?
And it's true. Where it ends, you could end the story, and like it's up to you as a viewer to decide like what happens next.
Yes.
Does he go on this quest to become that Messiah that they have prophesied and stuff?
Yes, which we all fucking know he is. So like, come on.
I mean, yeah, yeah. Like he saw the prophecies, you know?
Yeah. So.
So yeah. So, I mean, that's really it. Dune, did you guys see it? What did you guys think? Let us know. How can people let us know, Nicole?
Jeez, oh, it's going to make me do the whole spiel.
Oh, you want me to do it? I can do it.
It's fine.
I don't mind.
You can email us, remakesrebootsrevivals @gmail.com. Facebook.com/remakesrebootsrevivals is another way to reach out to us. We are at Instagram, @remakesrebootsrevivals. Twitter, @remakespodcast. You can find us on YouTube, and you can subscribe and like our videos there. And if you care to call us and leave us a voicemail, you could do so at this number.
862-248-2326. 862-248-2326. I hear my husband behind me. Did you figure out the word?
Mahadib.
That sounds right, actually.
It's teacher.
The Mahadib.
It's a teacher.
Oh.
Or teacher of children.
That's not the Messiah thing that they were talking about?
The preacher.
Oh. Huh. The preacher. There we go. At the very tail end of the episode, guys. You got the word. Yeah, let us know what you guys think of the episode. Also, please rate us and leave us reviews on Apple Podcasts. It will help others find us. And you know what? I'm just going to say it. The world needs more queer movie critics, and we are those. So, yeah, go ahead. Give us a 5-star review.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because we're the only ones, man. There have not been any before us. All right, well, on that note,
stay original.